there was one. I don't mean he seemed adventurous to a little boy, although he certainly was that as well. This man was the real deal. He had worked in military intelligence for the British government and had been sent on undercover missions to all kinds of exotic and dangerous places, both during and after World War II. He'd even met Ian Fleming, who had been in naval intelligence and who had subsequently used his experiences in that field to create the James Bond character. When he first joined the army, Billy became part of the Royal Scots Greys, originally a Scottish cavalry regiment. So he had all these wonderful ancient regimental swords that he kept on a table in his study. They were just beautiful, and they were also my introduction to the almost incongruous elegance of swords. When I was old enough, he used to let me handle them, and I imagined myself, among other things, as a swashbuckling pirate. I adored spending time with him, listening to him recount epic tales of his adventures in far-off places, much like Errol Flynn's character does with the little Indian boy in the film version of Rudyard Kipling's Kim. As he shared these stories with so much love, it also reminded me of the way Peter Falk's grandfather shares his love of adventure with Fred Savage's character in our movie, which is why those scenes so resonated with me when I first read the book. Let's be honest, for a kid, is there anything better than having a grandfather who not only fought for his country, but was actually a secret agent? I don't doubt that my grandfather suffered from some of the effects of his combat service, but he never once let on. Instead, he shared with me a passion for adventure and for life itself. He was the real hero in my world, and I treasured him. And he loved me, loved spending time with me. When he found out that I had gotten the part of Wesley in The Princess Bride, he was thrilled. He knew about the book, that it was an adventure story, and that I'd be playing a dashing pirate. He was proud of my success, and he had been really looking forward to visiting the set to see me work, particularly seeing the famous duel itself. Unfortunately, he never got the chance, as he fell ill around that time. When I went to visit him in the hospital, he was only semi-lucid. Age and the medication the doctors had given him had sapped his strength. Nevertheless, as I sat by his side and held his hand, I told him all about the shoot and how fun it had been. About Andre the Giant, about the sword fight, and how much he would enjoy watching it on the big screen one day. I even shared with him how much of a clot I had been, breaking my toe on the all-terrain vehicle. And then it dawned on me. It seemed as if the roles had been reversed. Here I was, the grandson, recounting tales of adventure to the grandfather. At the end of it, I kissed him tenderly on the cheek. Then, unable to fight back the tears, I told him how much I loved him. I realized I was actually having my as-you-wish moment with him. It appeared that he understood what I was saying. I'd like to think so anyway. Sadly, he passed away in the early hours of the following morning, surrounded by his close friends and family. The next day, I shared the news with Rob and some of the cast and crew when I arrived on the set, and pretty soon everyone knew about my loss. They couldn't have been nicer or more supportive. When I had to leave to attend my grandfather's funeral in the last week of November, I was supposed to film a scene that day, a wide shot of the dread pirate Roberts exiting his boat. But Rob told me not to worry, that I should go, because family always comes first. "Don't sweat it, Carrie," he said. "We'll use Andy Bradford to double you." As I said, when you're on a movie set, your co-workers can become like your family. On the 21st of November, I filmed my final scene in the film, the now famous movie-ending kiss between Wesley and Buttercup. That day was a busy one, with the call sheet being peppered with a lot of pickup shots that were needed, which we would be shooting in various stages on the Shepperton lot. Prior to the kiss scene, we shot a scene that actually never ended up in the movie. It was supposed to be an alternate ending where, after Peter Falk leaves the bedroom, Fred Savage picks up the Princess Bride book and is looking through it, at which point he hears something outside his window. He goes to open it, only to find all four of us, myself, Robin, Mandy, and Andre, on top of our four grey stallions outside his house, beckoning him to join us on our next adventure. Kind of like the concept behind Time Bandits, where the kids' dreams come true and the fantasy becomes a reality. It was to be shot against a black backdrop. There were no green screens in those days. and I was provided with a special Lipizzana stallion in order to do a specific stunt. Lipizzanas are famous for doing special tricks and maneuvers, and I was supposed to get the horse to rear up on its hind legs in a heroic fashion by giving it a certain cue using the heels of my boots. I had practiced for weeks with this horse between sword training until I got it right, and thankfully, the beautiful creature did not let us down when the cameras began rolling. The horse wrangler had also provided this huge Clydesdale, the kind you see on Budweiser ads for Andre, as that was the biggest they could find. And they had to build some steps for him to climb onto the animal. But this Clydesdale, as big as it was, took one look at Andre and refused to let him sit on his back. So the stunt team, who had prepared for this eventuality, had a standby harness built to Andre's specifications brought out, realizing that the only way to get him on this horse was to lower him gently in place while wired to a huge pulley, allowing him to appear to be on the horse without any weight actually touching it.
Rob Reiner.
So we've got to do this scene where we had to have them on the four horses, and they were going to be suspended. So we shot it against black. It was going to be a visual effect. Well, Andre weighed like 500 pounds, so he couldn't just sit on any horse. We had to rig a system where we would lower him down with pulleys, and we'd paint the cables out so he would just be resting on the horse. So we get to the end of the day, and it's about 8 o'clock at night, and I'm walking to the soundstage where we're going to shoot this. And they open the doors, and I see a 500-pound giant being lowered from the ceiling, and he's going, "Hello, boss." And I'm thinking, what do I do for a living here? What is this job I have? It was pretty crazy.
In the end, Rob felt the idea was too confusing for audiences, that the two worlds should not meet, and it turned out to be the better choice. After we finished that shot, it was time for Robin and I to shoot my last scene. Since Mandy and Andre had to go and shoot other scenes with the second unit involving the tavern, I said my goodbyes to them after we finished, hugging them both. I believe I became a little misty-eyed when I tried to wrap my arms around Andre. I couldn't believe that our journey was coming to an end. Robin and I were then led over to another part of the soundstage, where we were to sit on our horses against a beautiful sunset backdrop and perform the magical kiss. This would be my actual last scene in the film, and it couldn't have been a more appropriate way to end the movie for me. Once again, a crowd had gathered to witness the moment, watching and smiling, maybe dabbing away a tear or two. This last embrace, shared by Buttercup and Wesley, is described thusly by the grandfather in his narration.
"Since the invention of the kiss, there have been five kisses that have been rated the most passionate, the most pure. This one left them all behind."
We certainly did our best, Robin and I, to live up to that lofty standard. And even though Rob would often shoot multiple takes on any given scene until he felt comfortable that he got exactly what he wanted, when it came to this particular kissing scene, Robin and I kept asking for more takes. I think we were actually so giddy, we were giggling like a couple of school kids. After the first take, Rob called out,
"Cut and print!"
I'm sorry. I didn't quite feel right about that one, Rob. Can we try again?" I asked sheepishly, stifling a laugh.
Rob just smiled and said, "Sure, Carrie. Why not?"
After the second take, again Rob said,
"Print that."
Then Robin asked for another.
"Yeah, we need to go again, Rob, please."
Then I asked for another. So it went, three more takes, all of which concluded with the same directive from Rob.
"Cut and print."
We ended up shooting six takes of that kiss. After printing them all, Rob finally turned to Kerry, our script supervisor, and said after the last one,
"That's a beauty. Print that too."
He then walked up to us on our horses and said,
Guys, I think we got it."
Giggles aside, and I can't speak for Robin, but I could have gone on shooting that scene all day, as I don't think I wanted the movie to end. It was also a very tender way to end the movie, sealing it with a kiss, so to speak. There was a brief silence, followed by an overwhelming applause as Rob announced,
"Ladies and gentlemen, that's a wrap on Carrie Elwes."
I remember being very moved by this moment and trying hard to control my emotions as I gave a small speech thanking everyone on the crew and my fellow cast members. I turned to Robin and told her that no one could have personified the inner and outer beauty of Buttercup more wonderfully than she had. And finally, with a frog of unusual size in my throat, I turned to Rob and thanked him for being so incredibly amazing to work with, and for making the experience such a joyful one, not just for me, but for everyone involved, which was followed by the longest bear hug I have ever received from him. I ended by saying what was on my mind, and perhaps the minds of many, that I wish we could go on shooting the film forever, but that sadly, all good things eventually have to come to an end. After I was done, there were lots of hugs and tears as I said my goodbyes to everyone present. Robin came over and hugged me one last time. Of all the people on the film, I think I had bonded with her the most, as nearly all of our scenes in the movie had been just the two of us. I will always love her, and we will always remain close, because what we shared was a unique bond. For that brief, shining moment in time, we were Wesley and Buttercup, a fairy tale love that will forever be immortalized on the screen.
Robin Wright.
It was so beautiful, the story, the true love for Wesley, the true love for Buttercup. And Carey was so perfect for that role. He was so dashing and funny and good-looking, debonair. I think we'll always have a special relationship because of this film.
After the movie ended, everyone went their separate ways. I don't even recall if there was a wrap party. I'm sure there was. But I was spending a lot of time with my family, given the loss of my grandfather, so I might have missed it. Or I might simply have been too distracted by grief to go. I didn't know how the movie would turn out. I didn't even know when or where I'd ever see any of these wonderful people again. I felt good about the film and the work we had done. There is no doubt we all had boundless faith in Rob's ability to create something special. But we didn't really know how it would be received. As an actor, you never know. You finish one job, and if you are as fortunate as I have been in my career, you're on to the next. Maybe The Princess Bride would come and go. Maybe it would just be another line on the resume. Of course, we were all praying it wouldn't be. Only time would tell.
Mandy Patinkin. The whole experience was so intense. The 10 hours a day of filming and working with gifted people, and Rob's gentility and his generosity as a director, and his love of actors and all of us kids like Carrie and Robin and me being in this joyous, gifted piece by Bill Goldman. Now we were moving on, and who knew what it would be, whether anyone would see it or not. Christopher Guest.
The thing about movies is that no one knows if they've done something special. I think what you do know is if you've had a fantastic time. And from Rob's standpoint, there was no way he was going to know before cutting it together what the film really was. You know you have great stuff, but you don't really know. People have asked me about Spinal Tap. Did you know? And it would be preposterous and arrogant to say that we knew this was going to be something. It was just having fun with your friends. You're laughing, you're doing a thing that's basically it, and then you go on and do something else.
Robin Wright.
While making a movie, you never imagine or project whether the movie's going to work or not, whether people are going to respond to it or not. I just know that I loved going into work every day, making what we were making together on The Princess Bride. And in your mind's eye, you see the pieces fit together into a story of cohesion, and you think, wow, this is great. We're experiencing it. But you never know if it's going to translate. Well, this one did. We had the greatest time together, and I never laughed so hard in my life.
Chapter 13, A Fairy Tale Ending. The Princess Bride had been originally scheduled for a big summer release. The film's distributor, 20th Century Fox, was enthusiastic about the movie's chances and slated it to open on July 31st, 1987. But since Rob was still editing at that time, the date was postponed. I do recall a few months later being invited to view a rough cut of the film on the Fox lot with my then-agent Ed Lamato, who has sadly since passed away. I remember being particularly nervous at the time, as some of the giants in the comedy world, Mel Brooks, Gene Wilder, Gilda Radner, and Carl Reiner, were going to be in attendance, along with the rest of Rob's family and close friends. It's a strange thing seeing a film again after such a length of time has passed, in part because you've moved on to other projects. But also, it seems like eons ago when you made it. It's almost like a dream that has begun to fade slowly from one's memory. However, watching the film, even in its rough form, with all the temp music and cue lines running through the picture, I thought it was a joyous, heartwarming, funny, sweet, and sincerely memorable movie. But perhaps I was just biased. I do know that the audience appeared to love it too. But maybe, being Rob's friends and family, they were biased as well. After the screening, I remember feeling overwhelmed as I received perhaps some of the greatest and most treasured compliments of my career when Mel, Jean, Gilda, and Carl each took turns congratulating me on my performance. When The Hollywood Reporter suggested in an article on September 15th that the movie would be a challenge for the marketing department, the studio decided to push the release date even further back, opening with a limited run, meaning fewer theaters in New York and Los Angeles, on September 25th, to see how it fared before going wide, meaning more theaters, a few weeks later. The first time I saw the final version was at what was then known as Toronto's Festival of Festivals, now known as the Toronto International Film Festival, on September 18th, a week before the official release date in the States. Even after all this time, we still didn't know what to expect. As Bill Goldman says about our industry in his fascinating book, Adventures in the Screen Trade, nobody knows anything. For if they did, he correctly reasons, everybody would be making hit movies all the time. Nobody sets out to make a bad movie. You work hard, put your faith in the material and the director, and then, well, you hope for the best. Truthfully, there is so much that can go wrong that it's advisable not to dwell on it, which is also Goldman's advice. If it had been up to the audience at the festival, we would have been a smash hit. They loved it. They laughed in all the right places and appeared to be moved in all the right places as well. After the credits rolled and the lights came up, the audience stood and cheered. It was truly overwhelming. I remember looking over at Rob. He was beaming. The audience really took the film to heart and voted it as the winner of the People's Choice Award at the festival. It seemed like the movie had a real shot. Then came the heartache. As we were flying back to LA, Rob unfurled a copy of what the studio had chosen for the movie poster, and we were all pretty shocked. Apparently, The Hollywood Reporter had been correct in their assumption. The studio's marketing department had been at a complete loss as to how they should sell the film. The poster had no image of the title character, Buttercup. No Wesley, no Miracle Max, no Inigo, no Fezzik, no sword fight, not even an ROUS in sight. Instead, they opted for a one-sheet depicting a silhouette of Fred Savage and Peter Falk sitting together against a Maxfield Parrish-type background. Very sweet, but it seemed to be an odd static choice for a movie that promised so much more. Clearly, they were scrambling at the time, trying to figure out what type of movie to promote. And, for some reason, they decided to push the story of the grandfather and the grandson, in essence, a kid's movie. Granted, that relationship was an integral part of the story, but we all felt, including Rob, that perhaps it wasn't the best angle to promote the movie. And we were right, as it obviously left audiences confused and some potential filmgoers deterred.
Chris Sarandon.
The first movie poster didn't really tell you anything about the movie. The subsequent posters did feature characters from the movie and gave you a real sense of what the movie was about, but originally it was like, well, what do we got here, folks? We don't know, so let's just throw it out there and see what happens. I was very disappointed when the movie was first released because I just thought, this is really a very special piece of work, and it's not going to be the sort of thing that everybody gets right away. It may take some time. And that has proven to be the case.
To give you a sense of how clueless even the foreign marketing folks were, I remember someone showing me an Italian one-sheet that, granted, had an ROUS and Buttercup, but it also bizarrely featured a hawk and had Indigo as an Arnold Schwarzenegger look-alike from Conan the Barbarian holding his giant barbarian sword up to his face in that iconic pose. I guess the theory was that if Arnold could sell tickets, why not give it a shot? Compounding this was the fact that domestically, Fox had opted out of publicizing the movie at all in the media. We had no paid ads on TV or even a trailer in the theater. Indeed, the first and only trailer was considered so confusing, it was subsequently pulled from the cinemas by the studio. It all seemed like a recipe for disaster. And yet, despite all this, the reviews upon opening were generally positive. A sampling. The Philadelphia Inquirer. Given that Reiner's first feature was the riotously parodic "This is Spinal Tap," there is a built-in expectation here that he satirized swashbuckler derring do. But what's captivating about Bride is the sincerity with which Reiner tells his story, which is sweet like cider, and fortunately not like honey. The New York Times. The Princess Bride has sweetness and sincerity on its side. And, when it comes to fairy tales, those are major assets. It also has a delightful cast and a cheery, earnest style that turns out to be even more disarming as the film moves along. Even the little boy, who is a tough customer, is eventually won over. Chicago Sun-Times, Roger Ebert. The Princess Bride reveals itself as a sly parody of sword and sorcery movies, a film that somehow manages to exist on two levels at once. While younger viewers will sit spellbound at the thrilling events on the screen, adults, I think, will be laughing a lot. Some critics, though, were reluctant to give the film anything more than a backhanded compliment, with the attitude, "Hey, it's a cute movie, and if you need something to do in the afternoon, go ahead and take your kids." Others were simply put off by the apparent meshing of genres. One critic, for example, had this to say: "This is a postmodern fairy tale that challenges and affirms the conventions of a genre that may not be flexible enough to support such horseplay." Really? I think Mr. Goldman put it best when he wrote, "Cynics are simply thwarted romantics." 2 weeks after the Toronto Festival, and after the initial wave of mostly positive reviews, we all gathered once again for a screening at the New York Film Festival at the Ziegfeld Theatre on 54th Street. Rob went on stage and introduced the film, then invited us all afterward to join him up there so he could introduce us. Later that night, we all gathered for dinner, where Rob got up and gave a speech. "I just want you all to know that whatever happens with this movie, I am very proud of the work we did. More importantly, of all the hard work you did to help make this one of the most memorable experiences of my career. It's a very special film, and one I think we can all be proud of." Everyone applauded. There was a general feeling in the room of camaraderie, where we felt that we had made something special. Sadly, Rob's comments about the success of the film turned out to be somewhat prophetic. The numbers were not what we had hoped for, nor what the studio had hoped for that matter. After the opening weekend, we could already tell that the movie wasn't going to be a huge box office draw, something that confounded us all.
Mandy Patinkin. I saw a rough cut of the film very early on, before it was released, and I remember I was weeping when it was over. My wife was sitting next to me, and she said, "What's the matter?" And I looked at her, and I said, "I never dreamed that I'd be in anything like this. I can't believe this happened before I even had time to dream it." And I couldn't get over it. That was such a high. Then I remember feeling sad when it wasn't received well. I heard that the studio didn't know how to market it. As an adventure story or a children's story, who knew? And so it just sort of came and went. Fred Savage. They didn't know how to market it. Didn't know what it was. Is it an adventure? Is it romantic? Is it funny? Is it moving? Is it thrilling? Is it a children's story? Is it an adult story? And the answer is yes. I think any audience can find something in the film that speaks to them, because it does have its toes in so many styles, genres, and tones. It means something to everyone, no matter what you want from the movie. Rob Reiner.
Looking back, I was really stupid. I remember talking to Barry Diller, the head of Fox at the time, and I remember that when The Wizard of Oz came out, it wasn't well received. People didn't understand it. They didn't like it, even though it has since become this great, enduring classic over the years. And I said to Barry, this is terrible. We've got a movie that everybody loves, but we can't get anybody to come. I don't want this to become The Wizard of Oz. And he said, Rob, don't let anybody ever hear you say that. And he was right, you know. We should be so lucky to get The Wizard of Oz.
Looking back, I only wish that the internet had existed in 1987. I suspect that social media would have raised awareness of the film's unique quality and helped propel it to blockbuster status. Alas, movies in those days relied on traditional platforms for publicity, and we didn't even have that going for us.
Rob Reiner.
I was really happy with what we had done because we achieved exactly what we set out to do. And I was also happy with the reaction. I mean, we had test screenings that were like the cliche, through the roof, with something like 94% of viewers saying they would definitely recommend the movie. The thing that was frustrating for me is that Fox, who was releasing the film domestically, didn't know how to market it. They had no idea what to do with it. They couldn't cut a suitable trailer. They couldn't get a one-sheet newspaper ad. So it was really frustrating.
Andy Scheinman.
The movie wasn't as successful from a commercial standpoint as it should have been. I think it's a very soft title, especially if you don't know what it's about, and nobody knew. We couldn't get 3 college kids in the whole country to see this movie when it first came out. College kids would say, well, it sounds like it's for little kids. Even little boys would go, it's girly and princesses and brides and all that stuff. And then when we screened it at UCLA, the audience went crazy. Because, of course, the reality is the movie is quite satirical and has a very adult sensibility. It just happens that kids love it, too.
After dinner, when everyone was about to go their separate ways, Andre asked if I wanted to go out for a nightcap. Why not, I thought. Who knew when we would get to see each other again, and I always enjoyed his company. So I joined him as he squeezed into the large, chauffeured van he had and set off in search of... Well, when you're with Andre, you know it's always going to be an adventure.
I'll take you to some of my old haunts, he said,
issuing some directions to the driver. We drove only a short distance before pulling up in front of the first bar, a perennial favorite of Andre's, P.J. Clark's on 3rd Avenue. And of course, the moment we walked in, the place fell silent. Every head in the room turned to watch as Andre bent low as he entered through the door. It's really not possible for you to make a subtle entrance, is it? I asked. He smiled and replied,
Not always, but it's okay. They know me here.
As we sat down at the bartender immediately walked over. Hey, Andre, good to see you again. The usual?
Yes, please, Frank. And this is my friend Carrie. We just made the movie together, and I want to buy him a drink.
Nice to meet you, I said, shaking hands with Frank. Any friend of Andre's is a friend of ours. What'll you have? Just a beer, please. I responded, thinking I had better pace myself. Andre's usual turned out to be his drink of choice, the American, which he had let me try on location in Derbyshire, a combination of many hard spirits. In hindsight, I'm glad I didn't try a sample of it before getting on his ATV, as I probably would have ended up with a lot worse than a broken toe. The beverage came, as expected, in a 40-ounce pitcher, the contents of which disappeared in a single gulp. And then came another, and they kept coming while I gingerly sipped my beer. We talked about work and movies, about his farm in North Carolina where he raised horses, his relatives back in France, and of course about life. Andre was a man unlike any other, truly one of a kind. I remember him saying something quite poignant to me, that he would give anything to be able to spend just one day being regular size so he could go unnoticed.
But you know what, boss?
He continued. What? I asked.
I am still grateful for my life.
How come? I responded.
Because I have had an incredible one,
he said with gusto. And he was right about that. While we were talking, I noticed a man at the bar who seemed never to take his eyes off Andre. I didn't think this unusual, since Andre drew stares and fans wherever he went. Perhaps this guy was a serious fan. Then Andre gave me a nudge, an indication that it was time to move on. I remember him refusing to let me pay for the drinks, something Andre would never let you do.
"No, no, boss, I got this,"
he said, while leaving Frank a $100 tip. We went out to the car, drove a few blocks, and wandered into another of Andre's haunts. There was another beer, more Americans, more conversation, more laughs. That's the way it went, bar hopping to Andre's haunts all over Manhattan for many hours. Thankfully, I realized very early on in the proceedings that I would be in way over my head, which is why I only ordered beer, while Andre inhaled his Americans three or four at a time in some cases. At one of the establishments, I noticed the very same guy from the bar earlier on, sitting at a table, still staring at Andre. I continued to think nothing of it until we got to the next bar, and there he was again, the same guy. I leaned over to Andre. "Hey, Andre, I think that guy is following us," I whispered conspiratorially.
"Where?"
he responded, his large brow suddenly furrowing as he turned his head to look in the direction I had been looking. I thought to myself, if this fellow turned out to be a threat, he wasn't going to remain one for long. "Over there." I nodded in the direction of the stalker at the table, who chose to look away at that moment. Andre leaned back and looked at the guy. He then turned back and nodded nonchalantly.
"Oh, don't worry about him."
"Why? Do you know the guy?"
"It's a long story."
That was enough to pique my interest. Andre downed what appeared to be the last 8 ounces of one of his Americans and put the jug back down on the bar. After wiping his mouth, he said,
"He's a cop."
"A what?" I responded, clearly confused.
"A policeman," he replied.
It turns out that on one of his nights out bar hopping, Andre had had a bit too much to drink. And while he was waiting for his car from the valet, he slipped and fell over. But he didn't just fall on his butt. He fell right on top of a very surprised patron. I can only imagine what that felt like for the poor, unsuspecting fellow, who must have thought a building had landed on him. It could have turned out to be a major lawsuit, but I think the whole thing was settled fairly quickly and quietly. After that, the NYPD decided that whenever Andre went out for a drink, they would send one of their finest to follow him and make sure he didn't fall on anyone again.
"They said it was for my own safety."
This last comment brought a wry grin from Andre. I certainly didn't dispute the story because, although Andre was very tall, he wasn't prone to telling tall tales. Anything was possible. Once he recognized the undercover cop, he bought the guy a drink at every bar from then on. The cop responded each time by holding up his glass in acknowledgement and continued to tail us for the entire night. Pretty nice gig, if you can get it. Sadly, Andre passed away in January of 1993 from congestive heart failure. I was shooting a Mel Brooks comedy at the time and remember being heartbroken upon learning the news. It was very hard to be funny that day. Compounding the tragedy was finding out that he was only 46 when he died. Andre knew he wasn't going to live to a ripe old age, and even told Billy Crystal at one point during the shoot,
"We don't get such a good break, the little guys and the big guys. We don't live so long."
I think that is why Andre carried himself in life with that beatific smile of his. He never took a single day for granted, not knowing if it might be his last. He wanted to share how beautiful life was with everyone he came into contact with. He was as generous-hearted and sweet a person as I ever hoped to meet. The kind of guy who would give you the shirt off his back, a shirt big enough for 4 or 5 people. He never let anyone pay for a meal or a drink, as he wanted to be the one to give instead of receiving. This massive icon of a man taught me a lot about appreciating the small things in life and about living in the moment, and I am more than grateful to have known him. I feel honored. And in that vein, I am grateful that at least he enjoyed the experience of making the film as much as the rest of us did. I found out from his family and friends that it had been one of the highlights of his life. They told me that after it came out, whatever city he was wrestling in, which was limited to mostly making appearances since his back operation had not been a success. He would sneak into the back of a theater where it was playing and watch as much as he could without drawing too much attention, and told everyone he just loved it. That memorable evening I spent with Andre would be one of my last adventures in making The Princess Bride. What was kind of sad was that it seemed destined back then to be a relatively small movie, seen only by a smattering of people. Or so we all thought. Then, out of the blue, I guess if I had to figure out a date, it might have been around Christmas, 1988, the movie started to take on a life of its own. It was a booming time for the VHS market, and videos had become an enormously popular Christmas gift. And what better movie to share at Christmas than The Princess Bride? That first year, copies flew off the shelves, and they've been flying ever since in one form or another. My awareness of this phenomenon began in the strangest way, almost subtly, with the occasional fan coming up to me in public, telling me they had recently rented or bought the movie and how much it meant to them. Within a year or so, it became commonplace. Waitresses taking my order would invariably engage in a conversation that went something along these lines. "And how would you like that cooked?" "Medium rare, please." "As you wish." Smile, occasional wink. At first, I didn't know how to respond. I had little practice in being in the surreal position of becoming a matinee idol, which is what Wesley had suddenly become to millions of young women. It came out of nowhere. And at the time, there didn't seem to be a reason for this. The Princess Bride had disappeared. The movie was mostly dead, if not buried. And then, suddenly, it was everywhere. It had come back to life in a gloriously, wonderfully, and deliciously unexpected way. The resurgence came as a complete shock to me, as I think it was for the whole cast. But bewilderment quickly gave way to gratitude, a deep, profound appreciation for the good fortune that had come my way. There is simply no other way to put it. I felt blessed. The resurgence helped to boost my film career and provide me with a truly wonderful life. Once you are recognized from a particular role or film, everything begins to change. And when the movie is as beloved as The Princess Bride, you have bestowed upon you something akin to immortality.
Billy Crystal.
You know, I look back on that time as just one of the best times of my life, because it's a movie that endures that I can watch first with my kids and now with my grandkids and be very proud that I'm in it.
Among the acknowledged fans of The Princess Bride are people who have held some of the most prominent and influential positions in the world. On June the 1st, 1988, I got a chance to visit the Vatican with my mother. Through a series of contacts and connections, she arranged for a brief audience with His Then Holiness, Pope John Paul II. I didn't realize at the time that the Pope had a great love of the arts. Moreover, I wouldn't learn until later when I played him in a TV movie that as a young man in Poland, he had been an actor, a poet, and a playwright. He was incredibly literate and well-read. In essence, a true Renaissance man. But who would have guessed that his interests extended deep into popular culture as well? So imagine my surprise when we posed together for a photo and the Pope turned to me and smiled upon recognizing me.
"Ah, you are the actor."
"Yes, Your Holiness."
"The one from The Princess and the Bride,"
he said, miscalculating the title in a very sweet way that many people still do. I was stunned. "Your Holiness," I stammered, "you've seen the movie?" He nodded approvingly.
"Yes, yes, very good film, very funny."
As I write this, Pope John Paul II has just been canonized at the Vatican, which I guess means we can literally count a saint among the admirers of our film. Who knew? Some years later, on March 5th, 1998, I discovered that the film had fans high up in the government as well. I had recently finished filming a few episodes of an HBO miniseries produced by Tom Hanks entitled From the Earth to the Moon. The series about NASA's Apollo program, in which I portrayed Michael Collins from Apollo 11, hadn't yet aired, but luckily for us, it was given a rather spectacular and unprecedented liftoff. One day, I got an unexpected call from Tom himself.
Please hold for Mr. Hanks,
his assistant said on the phone. Then Tom came on the line.
Hey, Carrie,
he said jovially. What are you doing 2 weeks from Saturday? He said, getting straight to the point. Not a lot. Why?
Well, how do you feel about going to the White House?
He asked in that wonderful, playful way only Tom Hanks can. That's a pretty silly question, I jokingly responded. What's the event? He explained that it just so happened that the Clintons were big fans of the NASA space program, and they wanted to screen one of our episodes, specifically mine, dealing with Apollo 11, as part of the White House's Millennium series.
So get yourself a nice suit and we'll see you in a couple of weeks, okay?
He said before signing off. Since the series had 12 episodes, I was indeed fortunate that the one the Clintons chose happened to be the one I was in. So my then fiancée, now my wife, and I flew to Washington as part of an entourage that included, of course, Tom Hanks and his wonderfully talented wife, Rita, fellow producers Ron Howard and Brian Grazer, then HBO chairman Jeff Bewkes, and head of HBO programming, Chris Albrecht. All the available Apollo astronauts were invited, which was very cool, along with myself and my castmates, Bryan Cranston and Tony Goldwyn. It was an amazing evening, during which President Clinton revealed in a speech that Hillary, as a young girl, had once written a letter to NASA expressing an interest in becoming an astronaut, a comment that brought big laughs from the audience. The late John F. Kennedy Jr. was also there with his beautiful fiancée, Carolyn Bessette, and delivered a very moving speech in which he declared the space program to be his father's proudest legacy. After the screening, there was a big reception in one of the rooms in the West Wing. The place was packed, and in the center of the room, in the middle of this incredible swarm of activity, was the tallest man in the place, President Clinton himself. I remember thinking of it in movie terms, that if you had filmed the scene from above, it would have resembled a whirlpool-like vortex of people, all hoping to get closer to the epicenter where the president stood, all hoping, like ourselves, for a 2-minute audience with the most powerful and maybe the most charismatic man on the planet. And yet, as strange as this informal meet-and-greet seemed, it all sort of worked. My fiancé and I patiently waited in line, and eventually we found ourselves standing in front of the president. I stuck out my hand and began to speak. Mr. President, my name is... I got no further than that when he interrupted me with that wonderful Arkansas accent of his.
I know exactly who you are, Carrie,
he said warmly, like we were old buddies rather than two people who had never met before. As he shook my hand, he flashed that million-dollar smile of his. It was like staring into a set of blinding headlights. Instantly, I wondered whether something had turned up in my background check, the one performed on virtually all White House guests before they can be granted access. The anxiety must have been obvious, as the president quickly put me at ease.
Oh, no, it's not what you think,
he said, still smiling broadly.
I just wanted you to know that Chelsea and I are huge fans of The Princess Bride.
Chelsea is, of course, Bill and Hillary's daughter. I tried to picture them together, watching the movie like any other family. It seemed at once sweet and surreal.
You were great in this movie tonight,
he added, referring to From the Earth to the Moon.
But you were fantastic as Wesley. I just love that movie. Chelsea and I must have seen it over 100 times. I can quote almost every line.
I was, of course, both flattered and speechless. I managed to respond, Thank you, Mr. President. That means a great deal to me. After introducing my fiancée, who was standing right next to me, she quickly seized the moment. Mr. President, what if Carrie sent Chelsea an autographed copy of the script? Do you think she would like that? The president immediately locked eyes with her.
You know what, Lisa Marie? He said. I think she'd like that a great deal.
He then turned back to me.
You think you can do that for her, Carrie?
Absolutely, Mr. President. It would be my pleasure, I quickly responded. As soon as we got back to the hotel, I called Rob. I couldn't wait to share the news. Did you know the president was a fan? I asked.
You're kidding!
He was just as dumbfounded and delighted as I was. A few weeks later, I sent Chelsea the signed script. And a few days after that, I received a very gracious thank you letter from President Clinton, which still hangs on the wall of my office.
Rob Reiner.
I've had many encounters with many people from all walks of life who love the movie, but the strangest had to be this one. One night, Nora Ephron and her husband Nick Pileggi, who wrote the screenplay to the movie Goodfellas, wanted to take me to a restaurant where the mobster John Gotti liked to eat. So we went, and sure enough, in walks John Gotti with six wise guys. After we finish the meal, I walk outside, and there's one of these Goodfellas standing in front of a huge limo. The guy looked just like Luca Brasi from The Godfather. He looks down at me and he goes, "Hey, you killed my father. Prepare to die." I froze. And then he starts laughing. He says, "The Prince's Bride. I love that movie." I almost went in the street.
People have often asked me what my strangest encounter with a fan was. I once met a young lady who politely introduced herself, then proceeded to tell me how much the movie meant to her. After she was done, she swept aside her long hair to reveal a freshly imprinted and very red tattoo of the words "As You Wish" in ornate calligraphy on the back of her neck. She asked me to sign it with a Sharpie so she could add my signature as a tattoo. Naturally, I hesitated, wondering whether it was appropriate or not, but her mother, who was standing right next to her, insisted. It's humbling, to say the least, to realize that you are part of something that has touched a lot of people's hearts and skin. As I've said many times, I'm sure that my tombstone will probably bear the words "As You Wish," and I'm totally cool with that. It's a wonderful thing to be associated with such a beautiful, funny, warm-hearted movie, one whose popularity has shown no sign of waning.
Mandy Patinkin. It was one of the true privileges of my life to be asked to have been in this film, and most of all, to get to have lived long enough to witness what it has become, to see the pleasure it has brought to so many generations. I had no idea that it would have this effect on people. I guess the real pleasure of it is that this movie became far more than any of us ever dreamed or imagined.
A quarter century later, the entire cast, minus those who have sadly passed on, Andre, Peter Falk, Peter Cook, and Mel Smith, assembled, not merely as an act of nostalgia, but to celebrate something that has remained as vibrant today as it was when it was first released. That much was evident when we got together at Lincoln Center, as the crowd cheered with the entrance of each character on screen and shouted along with famous lines, working themselves up into a fervor. It was wonderful to experience that kind of response with the people who made it happen, some of whom I hadn't seen in years.
Billy Crystal.
The true test of The Princess Bride is time. We had a reunion of the cast. It was the anniversary of the movie at Lincoln Center. And it was like the Rocky Horror Picture Show. The audience was yelling out lines. They were applauding everybody's entrance. When Dear Peter came onto the set to meet little Fred Savage, they applauded like it was a Broadway star making an entrance on stage. When they saw Andre, everyone applauded. They chanted, "My name is Inigo Montoya, prepare to die." They yelled in unison, "Have fun storming the castle." We were all on stage together. Bill Goldman was there. And I looked at everybody, and it was like going to the best high school reunion you could ever imagine. It was really perfect. And then afterwards, we all had dinner together, and it was really kind of moving. And Rob said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm going to wait an hour to go swimming. You know, a good hour." And we just all laughed, and that was it. It's a beauty.
Watching the movie again 25 years later, I am in awe of how masterfully Rob directed it. I still stick to the theory that he was really the only director who could have pulled it off. He had the right sensibility, the right sense of humor, just the right touch to do it. The way he directed, the performances, the shots, the editing, the production value, the score, everything. There's not a single frame on screen that wasn't supposed to be there. After the screening, we were all patting him on the back, telling him how great it still was. And all he could say was, "It's kind of fun, right?" And we were saying, "Rob, it's a great movie." His response to that was, "You think?" He is truly filled with humility about his own gifts as a director. It's just one of the many very endearing qualities he possesses. We also found out that night that Goldman hadn't seen the movie with an audience since the initial Toronto premiere back in 1987. But he sat right behind me at the Lincoln Center event, and I could hear him because he has a very distinct voice. Every time the audience oohed, aahed, cheered, laughed, or recited a line, Bill would practically gush.
Oh my goodness, this is incredible!
He was stunned by the reception. And afterwards, as we prepared to go on stage and answer questions in front of a live audience, I found myself standing next to him. Well, Bill, what do you think? I asked.
I had no idea,
he said incredulously.
It's incredible. They knew every line. They loved it.
William Goldman. This movie was a remarkable experience. The best experience I've ever had. It just worked. You never know why, and you wish it would work like that all the time, but it doesn't. You never know what's going to happen with a movie when it comes out. Even if you've got a great cast and it's wonderfully directed, you just never know. All I know is it's different. It's an odd piece. But now it's become this whole thing, and I had no idea it would happen. I'll meet somebody, and they'll say, my daughter is 28, and it's her favorite movie or whatever. People seem to love it.
I smiled and gave him a hug. Of course they did, Bill. You wrote something beautiful. Bill nodded. For a moment, it looked as though he might start weeping with joy. But before he could do that, Rob took the stage and the crowd roared. After he thanked the audience for coming, he began calling us out onto the stage, and we all took our seats next to one another for a post-screening Q&A, which was moderated by the Film Society of Lincoln Center's Scott Foundas, who also organized the event. We recounted tales of making the movie, what impact the film had on us all the times we have had our lines spoken back to us, etc. Wally said that he believes that everyone he meets thinks that they are the first ones to come up with the idea of saying his lines back to him. Billy told of how he recently sat down to watch the film with his two grown daughters and his grandchildren, which was the as-you-wish moment for him, and how love for the film will most likely endure through generations. Then Bill, who was still very emotional from the screening, was asked a very poignant question about whether or not there was any chance he would finish the sequel entitled Buttercup's Baby, a chapter of which is included in the 30th anniversary edition of the novel. Bill sort of broke down a little bit, saying,
I've been trying for 20 years to do it. I'm desperate to write it, but I don't know how. I would love to make it happen more than anything else I've not written, but I can't. I can't crack the story.
It was very moving. At one point, a young man from the audience asked Robin if she would take a selfie with him, as it would fulfill a boyhood dream of his. Robin, of course, graciously complied. I was then asked to do my impersonation of Fat Albert that so impressed Rob on our first meeting, and of course, I couldn't let the audience down. The evening was one of the most enjoyable experiences of my career. I only hope that we get to do it again in 5 more years, or even 10. Perhaps a golden anniversary of The Princess Bride. Inconceivable? Maybe not. Why has this film endured when so many others haven't? What is it about this particular film that struck a nerve with audiences around the world to make it the beloved movie it is today? And I'm not suggesting it is Citizen Kane, but it has endured. There are many theories, but truthfully, I don't think anyone really knows. Does anyone know anything about what makes a good movie? Mr. Goldman, we know, thinks not. I have a theory, so, for what it's worth, here it is. I think that the film has endured because it was made with a lot of heart. And for that, we really have to look at the creative and tender hearts of Bill Goldman and Rob Reiner. Both men are very different people who came from very different backgrounds, but they share one thing in common. They have never lost touch with the love in their hearts for storytelling. And in this film, they were able to explore that love of storytelling in a way they perhaps will never be able to again. The telling of the most extraordinary fairy tale adventure story about storytelling that can now be counted as a classic.
Fred Savage. I remember years ago, I think I was in high school or just in college, I ran into Mandy, just completely randomly walking past him on the street. We had never met since we didn't share 1 minute of screen time, and we had nothing in common other than this movie, and I was like, I think we have to hug, right? We're both part of this thing. And we did. We hugged. And I felt this real connection with him, because this thing just pulled all these people together. I feel like my experience was unique in that I wasn't part of the camaraderie of the filmmaking. It was very separate in the film and in the shooting. And so I never met most of these people, but we still have this common experience that's kind of forever linked us all. Carol Kane.
It's almost like, in some ways, after all this time, we're like a real family. And now because this movie is so long-lasting, every so often we get to have our movie family reunions, which is just really such another great privilege.
Billy Crystal.
The Princess Bride, you know what, man? It's like a great old hat that you can pass down that somebody the next generation can wear and it still fits, you know? That's what it is. It's just a great old comfortable hat.
The film is indeed magical. It makes you feel different things upon every viewing. As Billy Crystal has said, it makes you feel good. It makes you miss your childhood. It makes you want to have someone read stories to you again. It makes you want to kiss your sweetheart, fight a duel, or ride a white horse into the sunset. All in the name of love. In short, it's the perfect fairy tale. As I look through my pile of fan mail, I know that even today, this film continues to touch the hearts of so many children, teenagers, and adults around the world. We grow old, but it doesn't seem to. It has discovered the fountain of youth. It is still out there, expanding and growing in ways we could never have imagined, and in ways we can't control. We don't own it anymore. None of us do. Not I, nor any of the other cast members, not Rob Reiner, not Norman Lear. Maybe not even Bill Goldman. It belongs to everyone now. And if you're among those who enjoyed this film half as much as we did making it, then all I can say is, well, you know.
Epilogue written and read by Norman Lear.
I was working on a deadline to finish my own memoir when I was invited to attend the 25th anniversary screening of Rob Reiner's film of William Goldman's one-of-a-kind book, The Princess Bride, for which I was its executive producer, starring the author of the volume for which I delightedly wrote this epilogue, Cary Elwes. While I couldn't get to New York and Lincoln Center, where an audience of over 1,000 fans ecstatically shouted out one memorable line after another along with the actors on the screen, at least a dozen people phoned and texted me as to the enormous success of the evening. Nothing I have ever been connected to has had a greater and more loving impact on its audience. Let me be quick to say I had nothing to do with The Princess Bride creatively. My erstwhile associate, Mark E. Pollock, oversaw the filming from a business standpoint. I simply fell in love with Goldman's book, then his screenplay, and agreed to finance the film. It stunned me that every studio had turned it down, even with the likes of Norman Jewison, Robert Redford, and François Truffaut attached to it. Having worked with Rob Reiner for 9 years, I knew it was right up Rob's alley, which is where I lived as well. William Goldman's script was deliciously faithful to his book, and Rob Reiner bringing Bill's characters to life was the perfect prescription for a heartwarming and hilarious film. Rob and his partner Andy Scheinman cast the picture brilliantly, what with Robin Wright as Buttercup, Mandy Patinkin as Inigo Montoya, Wallace Shawn as Vizzini, Billy Crystal as Miracle Max, Andre the Giant as Fezzik, Peter Falk as the grandfather, Chris Sarandon as Prince Humperdinck, Carol Kane as Valerie, Fred Savage as the grandson, Peter Cook as the impressive clergyman, and of course, Cary Elwes, the only actor I could ever imagine, as Wesley. The Princess Bride has to be one of the most beloved, not a word used often in this context, one of the most beloved pieces of cinema extant. Nothing has made me more proud than my relationship to it. Norman Lear.